The stage has got a little play to it. It's kind of like Altamont here.
Why are we fighting?
All right. Great to see so many friendly faces and folks I've known for many years and new friends as well. We are Monmouth University, of course, and we're so proud to welcome you to this conference, which is enjoying some nice international acclaim at the moment. And of course, how often do you get to go to Daddy Warbucks Estate? Right? So in any event, we have a great opening session for our conference today with our good friend Robert Rodriguez, who I'm sure many of you know. He's been a great friend to Beatles scholars and Beatles fans for many, many years. And Robert is going to speak to you today about the Escher demos and the making of the Escher tapes at, of course, George's home studio, and the work that the Beatles did or didn't do collectively to prepare for the White Album, and those sessions that, of course, would last throughout 1968 and result in the album that we're celebrating here today. If you didn't know, Robert here is author, an award-winning author, in fact, of many of the most influential Beatles books of the last several years, including his splendid book on Revolver, which I use regularly. Also, his terrific book on Solo in the 70s, really helping us to understand an interesting and vexed period of the Beatles' career, because, of course, that lens that was on them for so many years is very difficult to focus when they disperse. Robert has done some of the great formative work in helping us to understand those years. And finally, I'm happy to report that he is working on, as we speak, but a White Album book that will come out next year. And of course, me being kind of a smartass, said to him in a recent conversation, but you could be selling it at the White Album conference. And he said, and he's right, he said, no, because I need to, of course, have benefit of the box set. I need to complete my research and provide us with the fullest possible picture of these recordings. So to his credit, you'll see the White Album in 2019, and I guess Abbey Road in 2020, and then your Let It Be story will be 2021. Excellent. Okay, well, without further ado, Robert Rodriguez.
I have some thoughts on the Escher tapes, and I had to put them onto paper, so forgive me for reading off the text, but rather than miss my bullet points, I wanted to give you guys the complete take of what I put together here. It was May when John and Paul and George convened at the home of one of the band members, each armed with material they'd been working on. The room they gathered in contained a reel-to-reel tape recorder with which the assembled musicians had come to lay down their music, which was then in more of an aspirational state of being. United in purpose, they'd been looking forward to this day for weeks. It was an opportunity to showcase material informally, to hear what the song sounded like, in an effort to craft a blueprint for their path forward. What we fans have heard on this widely bootlegged tape through the years captured the sound of lighthearted camaraderie. They sounded relaxed and engaged. And if the occasional cock-up diminished the perfection of the moment, the spirit of exploration kept the vibe on a positive note. It was only in the 1990s when excerpts from this tape reached the public at large with the release of the anthology series. Only then did widespread awareness come of the recordings made at Fourth and Road in 1960, revealing a musical richness inherent in these teens. It was 8 years later, at George's home, that John, Paul, and George, now joined by Ringo, revisited an astonishingly similar situation. Back in 1960, they faced an uncertain future, with no Brian Epstein to guide them forward. Likewise, in May 1968, the manager who had presented them to the world and gave them the opportunity to feel the magic that he had first felt in November 1961 at the cavern was no longer there for them. Just as 8 years earlier, the path forward was unclear, as Hamburg had yet to materialize at that point in 1960. 8 years on, and with their place in popular culture assured, they were faced with the challenge of following up what had become the most acclaimed work of their career, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. If they were uncertain of what was the right move, who could blame them? In 1967, they still had the guidance of their manager, to whatever degree they still followed it, and a producer whose role had risen to the level of co-explorer rather than trusted guide who'd laid down the law in the beginning. But much had changed during the past year. Everything from the decision to take charge in both the studio and in business matters, which included the running of their own record label, as well as the personal lives of John and Paul, which saw the shedding of longtime romantic partners for new love that year. The group had embraced and then rejected the teachings of the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi as their TM guru, though they would remain adherents to meditation to varying degrees ever onward. But a year that saw them reach the absolute pinnacle of near universal media embrace with the Pepper album had by year's end turned on them with the scorn accorded their self-made holiday season TV special, Magical Mystery Tour. For the first time during their years of success, the act that could do no wrong suddenly found themselves accused of creative overreach. That 1968 began with the Beatles seemingly in a state of retreat makes complete sense. First, they ditched the sonic innovation and trappings of psychedelia for good, presenting a back-to-basics approach in their music going forward that was likewise embraced by their peers. Second, they withdrew from the public eye for a six-week-long immersion study of transcendental meditation in Rishikesh, India. Though the intent had been mastery of this new form of self-actualization to supplant their drug use, of which John especially had been frighteningly in sway to, the practical effect was to unlock their creativity in a way never before seen. I'm going to assume that all of you here are better informed than Giles Martin was a few years ago and are well aware of the existence of the Esher demos. These were the 27 original compositions taped as acoustic run-throughs at George's home, known as Kinfons in Esher, just before sessions for what is popularly known as the White Album began. They've been widely bootlegged for years, and in fact, seven of the recordings were officially issued in 1996 on Anthology 3. Some of the demos began life as homemade undertakings on tape at the individual Beatle homes. But George's ownership of a professional Ampex four-track recorder enticed his fellow Beatles out to take advantage of the capabilities of this multi-track machine, transferring over their cassette recordings and double-tracking guitar and vocal parts, a method they'd become accustomed to during their years at EMI, laying down songs for release.
Right?
Yeah.
Come on, come on. Come on, it's such a joy. Come on, it's such a joy. Come on, take it easy. Come on, take it easy. Take it easy. Take it easy. Everybody's got something to hide, except for me and my monkey. Go, the higher you fly, the higher you fly, the deeper you go. Come on.
Rather than a song-by-song description of what was recorded, I'm here to present the backstory, what these sessions meant in terms of group unity, in the wake of the disruption of established order that the past year had been for them. In December 1970, John Lennon gave an interview to Rolling Stone magazine at a time when the group's split was fresh. Discord between the band's two creative spearheads was beginning to crest. In it, he described the White Album as the sound of group alienation. Himself in a backing band, Paul in a backing band, George in a backing band, as if collaboration had completely ceased, and that they were no longer interested in working together as they had in the past, as editors of each other's work. His words throughout the Lennon Remembers interview have carried an inordinate amount of weight ever since. Jan Wenner did not challenge him, and far too many writers accepted the veracity of his declarations at face value for decades to come. But it is possible now to examine what the evidence is to uphold or dispute John's claims. Session audio between takes reveals that even in songs requiring only one Beatle, such as Paul's Blackbird or John's Julia, another Beatle was usually around in support, offering encouragement and suggestions for developing the material.
Well, I was thinking about that, in that stop pit. There should be something coming from the distance, a funny, an arranged sound coming from the distance. a fairly complicated one, like a bit of decoration, you know, that you've got on the back of a painting. Yeah. Suddenly comes up, and as it comes up close, then you start again. That's what I was thinking of the silence.
Right,
I was thinking of the silence as being something which...
A little bit of brass band, you know, a very nice little bit of brass band.
Yes, that would be lovely.
The distance, a little bit of brass band.
Yeah.
A little bit of Nielsen's brass band.
Something else was at work in their approach to recording this album. For the Sgt. Pepper sessions, there was a far greater emphasis placed on production rather than band interaction. Individual parts were laid down piecemeal, not always with full band participation on the backing track, before layer upon layer of extra instrumentation, effects, or vocal parts were added. It was a suitable process for achieving sonic perfection, and eminently empowering to producer George Martin, as well as Paul, who reveled in the prospect of breaking new artistic ground while staying ahead of the competition. But it left the others estranged from the results, lacking in perceived authenticity or group ownership. The new project would be different. In taking back control of the recording process, the Beatles were asserting their autonomy, reclaiming their status as a working band nearly 2 years after they quit performing live. This necessarily meant a diminished role for producer George Martin, who naturally would have been expecting to build upon the triumph of Pepper. But the Beatles were adamant. There would be no alter ego this time, and no attempt at sustaining any concepts, no matter how illusory. Lest anyone get the wrong idea, the collection of new songs would be entitled The Beatles, presented in the purity of an all-white album jacket, strikingly contrasting with Pepper's elaborate motif. In the studio, there was a further departure from the established practice when they decided they would tape the rehearsals of the new material in the hopes of capturing the take. Only then would they build upon this satisfactory group performance, adding any production touches required to create the finished master. It was an exciting concept, requiring them to scrape off the rust of group performance inactivity and retrieve the muscle memory of performing as a unit that had sustained them during the years of stadium shows where they could not hear each other. To that end, they decided to lay down embellished demos of 27 songs that we know of at George's Esher home. Putting new or developing songs to tape was something that the Beatles had long been in the habit of doing. The earliest surviving evidence of composing tapes during the EMI years dates back to 1963, when the song's primary composer usually laying down acoustic sketches to varying degrees of completion. Presumably, these tapes were shared with the others and George Martin in order to present an idea of where the song was going and what was needed. This was very much an individual, not a group, pursuit. That the tapes were then shared, we know. What exists of Paul's home demo for We Can Work It Out, for instance, has been bootlegged. The extant recording is marred by John's reusing the tape, wiping out most of Paul's performance by taping some stream of consciousness nonsense over it.
Trying to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run a risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work it out. Think of what you're saying. You can get it wrong and still you think that it's alright. Think of what I'm saying. We can work.
And this week's Willy couple number is a young couple living in Reading, Sussex. And they've won this week's golden dress. Are you ready for it?
Group recording of demos were largely unheard of to this point with the Beatles, although anecdotal evidence suggests that Paul at least had taped some multi-track demos on his own, overdubbing assorted guitar, bass, and drum parts, a la Pete Townsend. That the Beatles made a decision to gather as a group to lay down on tape their various new compositions before commencing work on the follow-up to Sgt. Pepper draws our notice for the out-of-the-ordinary occurrence that it was. Why would they take the time now to do this? Presumably sharing songs that the others may have already had some familiarity with, as they were all in the same place when most of them were written. Was it about formalizing arrangements in advance of their entering the studio to tape the group performances? Or could it have been in some way, consciously or not, an intuitive effort to reclaim some group mojo as a performing band, a way to reconnect with each other, especially in light of the Rishikesh experience, which ended roughly. It did not begin that way. In February 1968, the Beatles flew off to India in pairs, accompanied by their wives and, in Paul's case, fiancé. Although it was intended as a remote study experience, taking them largely away from the distractions and pressures of the pop star life in London, there wasn't the complete isolation from life as they knew it. To begin with, a couple of other rock stars were among their entourage, their friend Donovan, as well as the Beach Boys singer Mike Love. Also, a film star, Mia Farrow, who happened to be going through the process of divorcing her then-husband, Frank Sinatra, at the time. Also, along with the Beatles came guitars. Whatever expectations the group may have had going in for this to be a focused study could not have been fully sincere. It should be noted that the perception of the small group, the Beatles and their partners, the aforementioned notables, was in fact much larger, including dozens of lesser-known students. Furthermore, a number of people came and went during the period between the first Beatles' arrival and the last Beatles' departure from the retreat. Still, the Beatles found themselves removed from their comfort zone in a way that they hadn't been in years. The change in environment could not but help inform what would emerge musically in the songs written in Rishikesh. Another element that made the experience unique should be noted. For the first time in years, they were all but completely weaned off the self-medicating they'd come to rely on. Though unsubstantiated rumors of their LSD use in India have circulated, it should be noted that the Beatles saw TM as a replacement for acid use, and had publicly said so. Whatever enlightenment they thought it could provide proved to be illusory, or at least finite in effect, hence their commitment to the Maharishi's teachings. While the effect of abstaining from alcohol, weed, and whatever else seemed to be less obvious on the music produced by Paul and George, something more noticeable was stirred in John. Though he would offer up his romantic and artistic relationship with Yoko Ono as the cause of anything good that emerged from him from 1968 onward, it is hard not to conclude that being left psychologically raw in India without his usual coping mechanisms opened the floodgates to self-expression and productivity not seen in years. Yoko was nowhere in sight when these songs were written, although she was undeniably in mind for at least one of them. So what is it we can glean from the 27 songs committed to tape at George's Esher home? Here's a breakdown by the numbers. The resulting double album, known as the White Album, contained 30 songs. 31 if one counts Paul's Can You Take Me Back link between Cry Baby Cry and Revolution 9 as a composition. Additionally, Hey Jude was recorded and issued during the sessions, while a George Harrison song demoed at Esher, Sour Milk Sea, was recorded during the White Album sessions and featured three Beatles as backing band behind Apple artist Jackie Lomax. There were 27 songs that we know of demoed at Esher. Of these, 19 made it to the White Album. Of the 27 songs, 21 were written or started in Rishikesh, 5 were written after India, and in the case of Piggies, a song originally started in 1966, around the time of Taxman, was finished and demoed. Of the 27 demoed songs, 2 were passed over for the White Album and eventually taken up for Abbey Road, John's Mean Mr. Mustard and Polythene Pam. One of the 27, the aforementioned Sour Milk Sea, was handed off to an Apple act. 3 ended up on Beatles solo albums, John's rewrite of Child of Nature, recast as Jealous Guy, Paul's Junk, then known as Jubilee, and George's Circles, only resurrected in 1982 for the Gone Tropo album. The final two, John's What's the New Mary Jane and George's Not Guilty, were actually attempted for the White Album, but neither made the final cut. The latter of the two was eventually dusted off and re-recorded for George's 1979 self-titled album. There were an additional 9 songs that we know of that were written or started in India that were not demoed as Esher, as far as we know. Don't Pass Me By, I Will, Long, 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 Why Don't We Do It in the Road, Wild Honey Pie, Cosmically Conscious from Paul, Dura Dun from George, Look at Me from John, and Teddy Boy. Of these, Five would make it to the White Album, while one of the remaining four, three made it to solo release, and one, George's Derry Dune, would be recorded but never officially released. Yet.
One direction takes you years, another takes you days.
Finally, there were seven more songs written after the Escher demo sessions that ended up released that year. Six on the White Album, plus Hey Jude. Of these, perhaps Revolution 9 ranks as less of a composition than a mapped-out studio creation, for which a demo would not be expected. Goodnight, written for Ringo by John, is believed to have been demoed by John, but the tape has not emerged. Birthday was more or less created on the spot, and if the demos were recorded for Martha, My Dear, or Savoy Truffle, we have not yet heard them. This leaves Helter Skelter, a song like Revolution that exists in a heavy, fast version, a slow version, and an acoustic version.
Tell me, tell me, tell me the answer.
If we count the four songs recorded by the Beatles at the beginning of the year, Lady Madonna, The Inner Light, Across the Universe, Hey Bulldog, plus the Hey Jude single, the Jackie Lomax giveaway, two compositions Paul is known to have produced during this time, Step Inside Love for Cilla Black, plus the mysterious Etc., recorded midway through the sessions and gone unheard publicly ever since, we have a staggering 49 songs recorded or demoed by the group between the end of 1967 and the release of the White Album. A degree of productivity unmatched in any of their years of working together. Apparently, isolation and meditation agreed with them. With the taps of creativity running at full force, it is not surprising that the Beatles would assert early on that they would record them all. It is a sign of George Martin's diminished influence that his efforts to get them to agree to record just a single album of the quote-unquote best material fell on deaf ears. They were no longer on the same page artistically. Despite, or perhaps because of the critical slap they received after Magical Mystery Tour, the Beatles doubled down on their belief that only they knew what was best for them. Taking on the roles of businessmen proved to be a bridge too far, as events would prove in due course. But when it came to their music, no one could tell them what was what. Whatever internal squabbles they may have endured to this point, if challenged from the outside, they would circle the wagons and keep outsiders at bay. The mythical four-headed monster was still alive and well in May 1968. What came in the months ahead would test the esprit de corps like nothing else they endured to this point. That's a discussion for another time. In a way, Paul's off-the-cuff hidden track that bridged Crybaby Cry to Revolution 9 served as a statement of purpose for the album they created that year.
Can you take me back where I came from? Can you take me back? Are you happy here, honey? Happy? Are you happy here? I ain't happy here, my honey. Can you take me back? Can you take me back where I came from? Can you take me back? Can you take me back where I came from? Can you take me back? Are you happy living here, honey? Honey, are you happy living here? I ain't happy living here, baby. Honey, can you take me back? Can you take me back where I came from? Can you take me back? Can you take me back where I came from? Brother, can you take me back?
Can You Take Me Back to Where I Came From wasn't just a plaintive expression of nostalgic longing. It was a cry for a return to the spirit of something powerful that had bound the group together back in the days when they had nothing to lose. By making the choice to record their music informally as a collective in May 1968, just as they had in 1960, the Beatles showed that, consciously or not, the desire to get back to where they came from wasn't just a wistful desire. It was an actionable response to times of challenge that has sustained them always. Thank you. Shall we take some questions?
Yes, indeed we shall. I'll bring the microphone around. Here we go.
Good afternoon. This is a splendid event, and I'm really pleased to be here, as I'm sure everybody is.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. The question that I have is, were there any engineers, Jeff Emmerich, any of the other standby engineers doing the engineering on the four-track? And I assume that there were rough mixes made as they went along that were refined, or did they do it all themselves?
It would appear that George was kind of running the show because it was his machine, the Ampex 4-track that they were operating, and I think they trusted his expertise and familiarity with the machine, but there was no other official EMI engineers along with them. That said, I haven't, my package is waiting on my doorstep right now while I'm in New Jersey, but from what I've heard from people, I've heard the new release of the Escher demos is that the consensus is throw away your bootlegs, because what they did to fix the out-of-sync double tracking and things like that, it's like a whole brand new listening experience that some nodding heads in this room can attest to. So what they didn't do then, engineering-wise, has been done for us now. So for an unintended accidental album, I guess it's a worthy release.
Thank you.
Had their own home reel-to-reel tape recorders that, in fact, Dick James was their music publisher, had given them these machines because to him, music was money. And if they had any kind of musical thought that could potentially be turned into a composition to then be recorded by somebody, he wasn't going to give them the opportunity to lose it. So they were used to doing that. And Paul was the one that started experimenting by removing the erase head and making tape loops and that sort of thing. So John, in fact, had a home studio at Kenwood. In fact, that was where he brought Yoko on their first official date to make two versions. Would record these things individually. A lot of John surfaced during the Lost Lennon Tapes radio series when that came out, because Yoko naturally would have been holding on to his stuff. there has been talk of Paul having a lot of things that haven't been bootlegged just because he's not the kind of guy to get rid of anything. And what form, if they ever reach the public, it takes, that would be amazing. There's been a few things that have leaked out, but not necessarily from him. I think Alf Bicknell leaked some things. Their driver, he had access to some tapes. George, the Escher tapes, I guess Giles didn't know of its existence until he went to work with Olivia for the Living in the Material World documentary from Scorsese. And that's just when he uncovered, it's like, wow, what are all these tapes? So we know that George took demo making very seriously. In 1969 was his birthday. He went and multi-tracked demos for Something and Isn't It a Pity and All Things Must Pass. So he was actually producing his own demos by that time, late in the game.
Something in the way she knows. All I have to do is think of her. Something in the things she shows me. I don't want to leave her now. You know I believe in how.
To varying degrees, they all did that.
Thank you. The masters, so to speak, were out of sync because of how they originally recorded, or that the bootleg releases were out of sync?
The bootlegs, I believe, were taken verbatim from the tapes leaked from the Harrison estate. And it's pretty clear that in these performances and the overdubbing, what we believe to have happened is that individual Beatles demo or set taped their stuff, maybe reel-to-reel taped their stuff at home, brought them to George's where they could lay them down on a track and then add live double guitar, extra vocals and stuff like that. And so they weren't being terribly precise in the moment when they were doing that. You know, nobody knows exact setup, if they had headphones on and were listening to their own pre-recorded stuff or not, or if they were just kind of, you know, approximating it. So those were the kind of imperfections that were bootlegged and what we've grown used to. And apparently, because they had the multi-track original tapes, they were able to sync that stuff now and, you know, do a Jeff Lynne on it. Only it was Giles Martin doing it.
At 12 o'clock, a meeting round the table for a seance in the dark. With voices out of nowhere put on specially by the children for a laugh. Cry, baby, cry. Make your mother sigh. She's old enough to know better. So cry, baby, cry, cry, baby, cry. Make your mother sigh. She's old enough to know better. So cry, baby, cry, baby, cry. Make your mother sigh. She's old enough to know better. So cry, baby.
We're having listened to them a bunch of times. It seems on a few of them, it may have been that John or Paul brought something to George's and then was singing along with it, and maybe that explains some of the out of sync. And then on some of them, you can hear some hand clapping and tambourine on one or two things. So yeah. I think that possibly some of them embellished a little bit what they had done on their own to say, hey, this is how it goes.
Right. And in those tapes, you can really hear the sound of fun going on in that room, which is the cool thing about it. For all the retrospective looking back at 1968 and the White Album as being this horrific time, the same way people describe Let It Be, until we saw the outtakes and saw them actually having fun and joking around and stuff, there's much, much evidence going on of how well they were still functioning as a creative unit in 1968, despite everything that was going on around them. Yes, Emmerich quit in a moment of peak during the sessions. George Martin took a sabbatical, seeing himself as sort of marginalized. Ringo, of course, famously quit in August of 68. So there definitely was those moments. And you have the Derek Taylor quote, I never hated anybody as much as I hated Paul McCartney in 1968. That was mostly because of what was going on at Apple and Paul being boss to the underlings there. But it's neither one thing or the other. I got to interview Tom Murray not that long ago for the Something About the Beatles podcast, and he was a Beatle fan. He didn't know the day that he got called to do Mad Day Out that he was going to be photographing the Beatles. He had no idea. He thought he was going to be just helping drive and that sort of thing. And so he had certain preconceptions as a lifelong Beatle fan. He was 23 at the time. And he said that it was amazing. What impressed him about the Beatles was just how incredibly friendly they were to people they were meeting the first time, seemingly genuinely interested in their stories. That because he was the same age as George, they were relating and talking about sitar and things like that. And what he was really struck by was the dynamic between John and Paul. Now, we know about the Mad Day Out. Mel Evans was there, his son Gary was there, Yoko was there, and they were going from place to place around London. And it was very clear to him as an outsider but a Beatle fan at the same time that that was the real powerhouse dynamic, and they were just constantly bouncing ideas off each other. The relationship was still very strong, July 28, 1968, for whatever would happen to it later that year and the year after. That was still a force. And I think that that's something we should really consider when listening to the White Album. Rather than being the sound of a band breaking apart, it's the sound of a band coming back together after taking a year off with this theatrical production of Pepper and playing as a band again, as Ringo has said.
The narrative for the White Album for decades was negative, doom and gloom. It changed. When did it change and why did it change? Why are we hearing the truth about the positivity of that recording?
I think because we have access to a lot more things, a lot more original source material than we did. I mean, starting in the 90s, when we were getting the outtakes on the anthology series, that there was that great moment of Julia, John's recording it, the last song tracked for the album, and you hear Paul there encouraging him.
It was till then. There was just the one, wasn't there?
It was great. It was really great.
Well, let me tell you. Couldn't I go from there, you know?
Yeah, sure. We can go back if you want, John. Yeah,
no.
You're doing great.
Because that one was perfect, wasn't it?
It's a very sweet brotherly moment. There was the bootleg that came out, I think, in the 90s, Here Today, Gone Tomorrow, which has got like 40 minutes of Blackbird. And you expect it to be just Paul, you know, because we're accustomed to, well, one guy was in one studio, the others were in the other studios, and they're all recording separately. That may have happened at moments, but it wasn't by design, like they couldn't stand each other. It was because it was more practical for whatever was going on. And there's John during the Blackbird session encouraging Paul. It's then when he comes up with the suggestion of brass for Mother Nature's Son. So everything emerging has been sort of this counter narrative to, oh, it was awful and terrible and we couldn't. I mean, it certainly was grueling. It was the longest time they spent on an album, and they were under a lot of pressure. This was their first release for their label they were created while they were taking on all these other tasks that they were rather ill-equipped to take on. So if detentions were happening and flaring and arguments were happening more than in the past, and suddenly the situation was different in the studio because there was a Yoko Ono present and then a Francie Schwartz and then a Linda Eastman, you know, all kinds of things were going on, as they would show a year later, when the ante had been upped in terms of the breakdown in the group spirit, when it was became three Beatles against one. They had that terrible argument at Olympic Studios on May 9, 1969, where they were trying to pressure Paul to sign the management deal with Alan Klein, and he refused to do it. And they stormed off. No work was done that day. He ended up venting by jamming with Steve Miller that day. Getting it out of the system, My Dark Hour, appropriately enough. 4 days later, they're back in the balcony at EMI photographing the Get Back album cover. It's like when tasked with something forwarding their musical career, they could pull together and be professional. Just listen to the isolations of side two of Abbey Road. I mean, genius. No matter what was going on that had nothing to do with music, no matter how bitter and awful it could be, they remembered who they were at the end of the day when it came time to make music.
When exactly did the Esher demos pop up on bootlegs? Any idea?
I know on CD, I would say late 80s, early 90s. Initially, it wasn't everything. And then when the anthology came out, there was more. And now we've got 27. I think originally we thought there was 23 songs. So when I say the 27 that we know of, as always, it seems like there's an unlabeled tape somewhere that surfaces. Somebody discovers, oh, look, it's more of this. You know, that's how we found You Know What to Do from 1964. It was an unmarked piece of tape. So I never said the door is closed on new Beatle discoveries.
There is definitely one that is out there that was not put on. I'll leave it at that. No quote. Hold on, I gotta quote you. What's that, Bruce?
You're on tape.
Yeah, you're talking about the brass. Thank you for the talk. The brass in Mother Nature's Son. And I know Paul wrote a piece called Thingamabob for brass band. And I can't bring to mind quite all the other Beatles extracurricular music on top of the number of people. But it does seem like going back to brass bands, this idea of going back.
Yes.
In a very broad sense, not just within the band, but almost like within the culture.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
Absolutely. There was a thought I came up with. I hadn't shared with anybody before because I just thought nobody would care. But it was like, it's fitting that the follow-up to Sgt. Pepper is a double album. Because if it were a Roman god, it would be Janus. The two-faced, one facing the past, one facing the future. Because if you look at the past as it manifests itself on the White Album, you've got all these sort of callbacks to their musical past. You know, pop music and country, whatever else that would have informed them growing up in Liverpool. And then the future is represented by, you've got John's introspection and his songs that would be the basis of his solo career. You've got Paul's mastery of every genre, everything from I Will to Helter Skelter. You've got George's spiritual yearning represented in the songs he recorded in 68. And you've got Ringo. He's got two songs on the White Album. Good Night, representing Sentimental Journey, him as the crooner amidst the strings. And the other song, Don't Pass Me By, what's his second album? It's a country album. So it's like, you got future and past there, I mean, subconsciously, but that's how it ended up playing out.
Hello, Robert.
Hey.
Do you have anything to add about Alan Klein's management method, where he eventually became the owner of the Beatles catalog, and that maybe that was something that Paul was wary of?
Certainly, he had the reputation that preceded him as being bad news. Now, I've heard directly conflicting reports of what Mick Jagger had to say about Klein to the Beatles. Stones having lost control of their catalog of the 1960s to Alan Klein. And one is that they cautioned the Beatles, stay away from him, he's bad news. The other being, this comes from Marianne Faithfull's memoir, that he sort of sat on his hands and let them get involved with Klein, knowing that if Klein was tied up with them, it would make it easy for the Stones to pull themselves out of their bad situation because he'd be distracted. So, yeah, it's a little Machiavellian, but who knows? The thing about the Beatles is I think it's something that more and more is coming forward in study, is analyzing their drug use and how it affected what they were going through at any given time, their judgment, their actions, the music they were making. Joe Gooden did that terrific book, Riding So High. I don't know if anybody here has read that. Highly recommend it. He doesn't want to come on the show because he's interview shy, but I'm going to do something on the show anyway with that book because it's terrific. And maybe if John hadn't been so enthralled to heroin at the end of January 1969, where Klein makes his entree into Beatle world, he might not have been so impressionable, because the John of 1964 seemed to have a pretty good bullshit detector. The John of 1969, not so much. And Paul, who knows what he knew about Klein other than a bad reputation, and there was no adequate defense of bringing him in at that moment. But, you know, management 101, your first job, if you're going to be a manager, is keep your clients happy and productive. Instead, he went in there with a divide and conquer strategy of pitting the three very consciously against Paul. That was not good for anybody.
Much like the gentleman sitting behind me, the first thing I want to do is thank Dr. Womack for this, what we assume will be a fantastic seminar. It is truly wonderful to be here. It's a thrill. Had to go there. My question is, with the Escher demos, has the Peter Sellers story completely disappeared? Was that just a fallacy that they were doing that as a gift for him because he had had a heart attack or something of that nature?
I think it's two different things. If you're referring to the Peter Sellers tapes, that was apparently a spool of White Album tracks in progress, because there were things that were changed along the way. Some of the fade-outs were done quicker. There was, like, in Sexy Sadie, they edited out a whole musical portion of that. But that was a tape that apparently Ringo gifted him when he did his walkout in August of 68, and he went to hang out in Peter Sellers' yacht. That is like, here, check this out. And wasn't anything done for him, per se. It's interesting, their relationship, Peter Sellers, to the Beatles. They started out as big fans through the Goons and Feather and George Martin's cap that he'd worked with them when the Beatles were first signed to Parlophone. And then, of course, Ringo ends up working with him on Magic Christian. But in between, people might be familiar with the time at Twickenham when it was after George's walkout and Peter Sellers stops by and they're making drug jokes. And Peter saw was like getting nervous, like, you're aware this is being filmed and taped, right?
Remember when I gave you that grass in Piccadilly?
I do, and man, it really stunned me out of my mind. It's really, Acapulco gold, wasn't it?
Exactly.
That was really fantastic.
Weekend gate.
I'm not holding any right now, I'm sorry.
No, which they have now given up, you know.
Oh, yeah.
As stated by Hunter Damiel in the Beatles' actual life story.
Well, I'm sorry about that, fellas, but if I'd have known I was going to see you that quick, I would have had some on me.
Yeah.
Because I know how you love it.
Yeah.
Dig.
Sure.
Right, dig.
Gotcha, Pete.
Got it.
I have yet another question for you. So we've got the White Album with all sorts of demos and early takes, and we've got Sgt. Pepper, same treatment to some degree. But we haven't seen Revolver. And to the best of my knowledge, I haven't heard all the tracks from Revolver in early stages. Some, yes, yeah.
Yeah, there are some. I mean, we know from Anthology the rehearsal of I'm Only Sleeping with the vibraphone on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the 30 seconds that exists of it.
But a comprehensive set of outtakes from that would be welcome. And the others came out on their 50th anniversary. And why did we miss Revolver?
My first guess, I mean, I'm sure Bruce can give you a better answer than me, but my first intuition would be marketing. Is Sgt. Pepper is making the bigger splash. You got to do it for that. And it did so well that they went ahead and greenlighted White Album. But the other answer would be that there's less to work with for Revolver beyond Isolations. People know what monitor mixes are. There's a lot of those that get bootlegged where it's basically audio of what's going on in the control booth of the Beatles listening to the works in progress. So it's not great audio. It's the sound of the multitracks coming through speakers and maybe hearing them comment on it, stuff like that. You don't have the masters to that stuff. You just have what tape was run on. So I think with Revolver, sadly, unfortunately, there's a lot less to work with. If they were to approach Rubber Soul, the further back you go, there's even less and less. But there are things. People familiar with Dutch imports know that for the vocal tracking session of Think for Yourself, there is, I think, at least 14-minute-long tape of them goofing around the studio. That is hilarious. And apparently George Martin ran the tape because they were behind schedule. They needed to crank out a Christmas message. And so he thought if he ran tape, maybe something usable would come of that that they could use for the Christmas message. But
how come you fuck up everything that you do?
I will be pleased to see the Earthmen disintegrated.
Okay. Go from just all the, you know, the beginning of the last verse.
What did you do then, Paul? Very interesting.
Although you're mad upset, I can't explain the things. And you've got to...
I'm sorry, sometimes I feel less than useless at these sessions. I really do. Of course, Cynthia understands. I often talk to her about it when we get home. I say, sometime, you know, Cynthia, I just go and get the note.
Well?
She understands a lot of things like that because she went to Bali.
Yeah.
For our holidays.
Yeah.
You know, Bully Alley.
Hello, love, how are you?
It's hilarious. It just makes you wish they ran more tape on all of their sessions that we'd have access to. We're out of questions. Thank you all for coming. I really appreciate you being here. Have fun. All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Robert. That's what a way to kick us off, providing a great paper. I have to make two observations. One, somebody should hold Bruce down and get him to tell us what that 28th demo is, although he may not be talking. Now he's shaking his head. We can convince him. And then secondly, I loved your line where you said, I didn't think anybody would care. It's a Beatles conference. Everybody cares. So you may have to revise that. Okay. Thank you so much. It'll be an outtake, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
It'll be in the remix version.
It'll be in my Russ Longgrass demos.
Yeah, your box set. The WLB demos. I love that. There you go. That's right. Well, I'm looking at the time. It's 4:45 or so. Our dinner is approximately at 5:30, but I bet you we start a little bit early. And so this will give you a chance to leisurely stroll back up the stairs. If you'd like to have a comfort break.
From Miami Beach, Bay OAC. Didn't get to bed last night. On the way, the paperback was on my knee. Man, I had an awful flight. I'm back in the USSR. You don't know how lucky you are, boy. Back in the USSR. Been away so long, I hardly knew the place. Gee, it's good to be back home. Leave it till tomorrow to unpack my case. Honey, disconnect the phone. I'm back at the USSR. You don't know how lucky you are, boy. Back in the US, back in the US, back in the USSR.
Well, the Ukraine girls really knocked me out. They leave the West behind. My soul girl make me sing and shout. That Georgia's always on my mind, my mind, my mind, my mind, my mind.
Flew in from Miami Beach, BOAC. Didn't get to bed last night. On the way, the paperback was on my knee. Man, I had an awful flight. I'm back in the USSR. Oh, you don't know how lucky you are, boy. Back in the US, back in the US, back in the USSR.
Well, the Ukraine girls really knocked me out. They leave the West behind. And my soul girls make me sing and shout. That Georgia's always on my, 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 my. I've been away so long I hardly knew the place. Gee, it's good to be back home. Leave it till tomorrow to unpack my case. Only disconnect the phone and back in the USSR. You don't know how lucky you are, boy. Back in the US, back in the US, back in the USSR.
Something About the Beatles, created and hosted by Robert Rodriguez, executive producer Rick Way, title song by The Corgis.
Okay.
Mm.
Oh, that might be an idea.
Let's take it from
through.
The top and run it.
Don't take it from the top.
I mean, yes, okay. But let's run it from there, then.
From there? Here
it comes. What's wrong? You got down to right about...
Any old top? Right
about...
No,
I
you know, little things like that, Paul, can just throw me.
Yeah?
Can we just do the little bit together and let me? Because I've forgotten what it was.
All right.
Just the last one. And you've got time to. Come on. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. And you've got time to identify all the things.
I don't know.
What key are you in? Jack,
I don't know.
And you've got time to rectify. That's me.
Oh, good luck.
And you've got time to rectify all the
magic.
And you've got time to rectify all the things that you should.
You
should have got me there, boy. I was moving.
You've got time to rectify.
Until I'd know him to get back in here, you know. He's kind of grooving out of the place, you know. Is he? I can bet that it's just a drawing.
Okay.
Oh, I've got it now. Listen to this. I'm going to give expression as well.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.